Welcome back, everyone. This is The Change Show with Simon Phillips and my very special guest, Mr. Michael Don Smith, who likes to be known as Don. How are you doing, Don?
I'm doing really well, Simon. So pleased to be here and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, Don and I met quite a few years ago when we were both on a platform called Ecademy, which was a sort of a forerunner of platforms like LinkedIn and Facebook, where people who were in business networked to get to know each other, but also to see if there were opportunities to help each other. And Don, I observed all the time, is helping so many people craft their sort of leadership message so that it became more powerful and more memorable. And that was my sort of abiding memory of Don. And we've caught up together a few times over the years. And we caught up really recently. And as usual, he was overflowing with the things that he was doing and the things that he was planning and just so much to share. So I'm really excited to have some time today, Don, to spend with you. So tell us a little bit about what I call your origin story. How did this experience and ability to help people craft a really compelling message as leaders, where did that all start?
Well, it started as the Royal Navy advert says when I joined the military. So I actually joined the Royal Air Force as a young man. My 17th birthday was my first day in the Royal Air Force. I was there for about 11 years, the last 5 years of which I was an avionics and aerospace instructor at RAF Cosford. And during that time, I've been at the front of the room as an instructor. You're delivering from the front of the room. So I spend a lot of time crafting my personal ability to deliver information. One of the good things about being in the Royal Air Force, though, is if people don't pay attention to you in the class, you can lock them up. But there's not a discipline problem. But
that brings that brings a whole new meaning. There's a slide I use occasionally when I'm training people, which says, "Why are you here?" And one of them is, you know, I've been told to. Another one is, I can't wait to learn. And another one is, I'm a prisoner. It was diary, and I didn't have a choice. And it's like that brings a whole new meaning to it, Don.
Man, but it was a great environment. Being, teaching at Cosford was fantastic. It was, probably still is, one of the greatest teaching environments out there. So it's very powerful. But what I learned was that I loved doing it. I really enjoyed delivering, being at the front of the room, from first being afraid or scared or whatever. Over the years, I learned it was really good. Then that moved with me into Mercury Communications, where I got into project management, where you had to lead. But I call project management the sneaky leadership skill, which is LSSLS, because I like my acronyms. The sneaky leadership skill, because when you're a project manager, you're not the manager of the staff on the project team. So you can't bully them, cajole them. You can't use that power, that authority influence. You've got to influence them with your personal compassion, co-ownership, collaboration. And so I learned from early that if I wanted them to work really hard for me and do things for me, it was through personal power. And I had to be able to communicate the objective, the vision of the project had to be bought into by the project team. So that almost, I like them to be more interested in getting my project delivered than being pleasing the guy who was paying them and feeding them responsible, which is a tough task. And then when I left Mercury and set up my own independent consultancy, those skills are good. Now I sort of started my training, my personal branding mission as a speaker. I worked with Tony Robbins, Master Coaches, went to Colorado, did the training with them to learn from the best of the best. But I found out that people, although they wanted to be speakers, they wanted to be on the stage, they didn't understand that they needed to be on the front of the stage. What I say to people is, if you're running a networking event, or if you go to a networking event, the person who gets the most bang for the buck is the person who runs the networking event. Because they get to network with everybody. They know about everybody. Same thing when you're at an event or a meeting, or if you're pitching, you're at the front of the room, and those skills to have a really good grasp of it, I call it the DNA of your speaking. You've got to understand that. And I think that's what I really love working with leaders, to be able to deliver their message, deliver their vision on behalf of the audience, not on behalf of the company.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that distinction then.
So, well, the distinction is what some people, a lot of people come to me because they're nervous and they're apprehensive about speaking in public. The story that illustrates that the most powerfully, which is a true story, a senior manager of a Fortune 500 company, very confident, very accomplished, really gregarious, outgoing, you know, laugh a minute guy. He was in the toilets at a conference in the stalls, as we call them. I don't know if that translates around the world, but he's in the bathroom in the locked door, and two other people came into the bathroom of his staff, junior staff, you know, quite junior staff. So they most probably weren't expecting him to be in the bathroom or anybody. And they were talking, they were laughing and saying what an idiot he was. And they were mocking all his ums and ahs and his stupid joke that he told at the last conference. And they really ripped him apart. And he was very hurt. He was a nice guy. He was really hurt because he thought he was this wonderful person.
Mm.
So he came and he worked with me. And obviously it was transforming around. But when you're at a senior level, the higher you go, the less likely people are going to tell you that there's a problem. Because if your boss three steps up says to you, how was my speech? You're not going to give him the truth. You're going to say, oh, it was fantastic, sir. Really good. I really like the story that you told. The same was last year. Oh, I enjoyed last year as well. So the distinction is that you could be passionate about your message. You could be absolutely sincere about what you want your company to do. And so you're pushing that and you get out on stage. And but if it doesn't connect with somebody who's got, let's be topical, petrol's going to hit £2 a gallon in the next couple of weeks. You've seen it. One night, the food bill's going up. You know, they've had to cancel the holiday. They may have just come back from Heathrow being in a queue as long as being on holiday. So if you're, and you know as the leader that if they work, if your company grows and sustains and survives this, they're going to thrive and they're going to be able to get all these things back. So in your head, you're giving them the message that you know will do all these things for them, but you don't, this is just an example, you don't give them the fact that this is going to mean you won't care if petrol goes up because you're going to get paid more, we're going to be here. So it's crafting the message from the point of view of your audience's values, beliefs, wants, desires, and needs. You must understand your audience so that you can fit your message to them. And last point, you know, that's where you get to put a speaker on your show, they go on. But the last piece of that is when you're concentrating on the audience, you don't have any confidence issues. It's when you're thinking about yourself. How do I look? How do I sound? What are they thinking about me? Then you become self-conscious and then the confidence dips. Even a great leaders, they spend so much time thinking about them and their message when they should be thinking about the audience and their message.
Yeah. And I know in part two, I'm going to ask you for some more of your sneaky top tips of people who are out there thinking, you know, maybe I've got a talk coming up soon and I'm not maybe feeling overconfident about it. Have you got any sort of quick tips for them? And I know you'll probably have a bundle, but so your story then, so you went from the RAF, you went to Merck, and then you set up your own organization. And a lot of your time, I know, has been spent leading workshops and also in those one-to-one settings. What would you say have been the key things that enabled you to navigate those waters of change in your own career? Because I do a lot of work with individuals who are contemplating career moves, but they maybe don't have the confidence to step out and do it. What gave you the confidence that was a good move to make out of a big corporate and off and running with your own business?
Wow. Well, that's a great question, Simon. the first move from the military into the corporate world, which was really, really a big move. I mean, spent sort of my youth, I grew up in a military environment, then going into a corporate. So actually, what I wanted to do was use my technology skills in civil industry. And being in the Air Force, you get restructuring, the help you get, you know, get a job in City Street, as I call it. So I remember the first interview I went to, so the first change was I had to get a job. So I was leaving the Air Force, been in there long enough, and I knew that technology was going to explode because we had some visibility of integrated circuits of like in the military, because we got the leading edge technology. And I was teaching it, so I knew what was going to happen with communications. So I wanted to join Mercury Communications. I remember my interview went something like this, because telecoms is a lot different to avionics. The principles are the same, it's a different world, and militaries are different to commercial. So my interview went something like, what do you know about loop decadic, which is for any telecoms people who's, you know, and I go, nothing. Okay, what do you know? So I didn't have any answers to his questions. And I was feeling, I was getting more and more depressed as the interview went along, because I didn't know anything about telecoms. And I've been training in telecoms for 5 years, so it just wasn't working well. And then he says to me, okay, you're out on site, you've got a fault, so you've got a job to do, what are you going to do? And I remember this from the military. God, Commander, I'd call you. So the first half was, I don't know. The second half was, I'd call you. And somehow I got the job, and I mean, I did really well. So it was very hard. So the first move was just, as happens in life, it's forced upon you. Circumstance change, you just got to deal with it. And the second one, which is much more interesting, was I got a call. I was coincidentally part of the telecoms revolution, going from analog to digital. I know if you remember, there's a lot of time when people were moving from fixed phones. Mercury brought out one of the first mobile phones. So I was in that space, a lot of change. And because of that, I picked up some very valuable information that only a few people literally on the planet knew, like the technical aspects of local number portability, the technical aspects of delay, you know, echo cancellation. Because we make international calls now, we don't realize that technology to make the call sound like it's real time is tremendously advanced. So because I was there with my military background training and then in telecoms at the right time, it turned out I was quite valuable. So I was headhunted to go and work for CETA, which is an international telecommunication association, and before that AT&T. So I was quite popular because of the skill set I had. But then they said, well, this is a contract, it's not a job. I'd only ever had jobs, really long-term jobs. As one of my friends says, I had a very entrenched employee mindset. I didn't go out and win business, 100% not, you know? Somebody gave me a job to do and I did it very well. And I was very happy with that. But then I had this lucrative opportunity to become an international telecommunications consultant, which is big bucks at that time, if you can remember the loads of money era. I'd sit down and talk to my wife and my family and say, look, you know, it's a 1 year contract where I'll get sort of 3 years money, but then at the end of the year I've got to go out and sell myself and do it again. And that was a really hard decision to make. And in another interview we can talk about that, because there were some personal issues that came out of that. But yeah, it was very, very hard. And so
to make that change, you consulted the people who are close to you. And presumably you had to do some soul searching in there as well, in terms of, so what does this mean for me? Do I feel I can do that? You know, what were the fundamental personal decisions that you had to go through?
Exactly what you said there, Simon. You know, what does this mean for me and family long term? And the challenge was, the upside, it was really, really good. The downside was that there was no safety net. So all my life, I'd had a massive safety net, and I had that corporate employee love. And so we decided to, you know, to take the chance. Do I regret it now? Clearly not, because I met you, got into with Thomas, Tony Robbins, I got into the personal development. So it's fantastic. I'm really, really glad I did it.
At the time, it can just feel like,
Scary. But it was a really, really And in fact, I mean, it was good when the going was good. When it really got tough was obviously after the dot-com crash and the bust. And I don't know if you remember, but people were leaving university and going into jobs at 35K. And the future really bright. Then all of a sudden, Mercury had to lay off 8,000 workers. BT was shrinking. So the whole world just fell off a cliff, pretty much like now.
So tell us a little bit then about, you know, some of the circumstances your clients approach you from, specifically those in that sort of leadership space.
Yeah, well, lots of stories. Just want to say it's a pleasure to be on this interview. Simon is really good. We've spoken at the beginning and the end. He's really managed this in a fantastic way. So I've got a plug in there. Really, really great interview. And the questions are tremendous. So one example is I was working with a very large organization, and I was doing all of the staff were going through a change program that I was leading, which was Learning for Life. So the program I used to run, and being the sales destroyer, I think someone called me, I'm a sales destroyer, so I can kill it. You know, a sale could be completely finished and then I'll go, a sale has been made and I'll go in and break it. So this is one of my attempts to break it. So I got this job. So it's basically a huge contract, training all the staff, 2 days offsite, all inclusive. They said yes, 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 everything I was going to do. And then I said, well, there's just one more issue. I can't do it unless the guy, because it was a transformation, there was change the company. So I'm not going to go on stage and say lots of stuff until I've got the buying from the director, the top guy. So I said, yeah, you've got the, you know, he's paying you. No. The audience have to know that what I'm saying, this guy's signed off. Because, well, yeah, he'll do that. Doing a memo says, no, you don't get me. He's got to be on stage with me at the beginning of the conference, and he's got to deliver a 3 minute talk about 3 to 5 minute talk about this issue and why this program's so important, things like that. And they said, yeah, you'll do that, it's great. I said, no, that's not enough, he's got to do it the way I want it done.
So I see, and now I can understand why you're called the sales destroyer. It all makes complete sense.
So I'm in the So I have a meeting with this guy, a great guy, we became great friends, but I'm sure you might mind me sharing this story. We sat down and I'm 6'2" and this guy was taller than me, very imposing, really, you know, he was the epitome of a chief executive officer 10, 15 years ago, you know, fully big office, imposing on it. And I was quite nervous. And the first thing he said to me is, I understand what you're asking for, Don. I just have to share with you one thing. I've been a senior executive. I've run this company for 30 years. I've given hundreds and hundreds of presentations, and I'm very comfortable with my presentation style and my abilities. So I want to let you know. And at that point in my head, I was thinking, oh my gosh, this guy's really got his shit. Sorry, he's got his stuff together, and he's going to blow me out of the water. And then the next thing came out of my mouth was, says, but I've always wondered how I was coming across and what I came across, so I really appreciate this opportunity to go over my speaking stuff with you. I thought, wow. And we went through it, and I was tough with him. And what I wanted from him was a story about change. And you'll like this one. So, and he kept giving me stories, you know, layoffs. So I said, nah, I'm not feeling it. He kept going and going. He was starting to get stressed out with me.
Regret the request.
Big time. And then we came, finally, after digging, he said, okay, I've got it done. I've got it. I know what you want. Because when my eldest daughter went to university, she wanted to move to a university, let's say Wales, university, you know, somewhere for Cardiff University. And we were in the Black Country. I moved to Cardiff University. She wanted to be by herself. And he was nervous about that anyway, because, you know, loved his daughter, dad, daughter relationship. Very nervous about going away from home for the first time. And then she said, and I want to live off-site in a private house. I said, oh my gosh, what? And then, making the story short, with 3 boys. So his youngest daughter, sorry, his eldest daughter, go off to university, going to live off campus, and going to live in a house with 3 boys. And he's like, it's his whole body just wanted to say, no way, not over my dead body. But he bit his lip, as he said to me, bit his tongue, bit his lip, and he said, okay, that's fine. You know, you're an adult now, you're going off the world, and I've only got one request. Can I help you move all your stuff to the new accommodation so I can see it? She went, yeah, it's brilliant, Dad. You know, wow, give me, yeah, definitely. You know, you said yes, and you're going to help me with the stuff. Wow, she was really happy. They went down there. He was, you know, very nervous. He's really scared. But when he met these guys, they were great. And it clicked, and over time, they became her best protectors while she was there. Maybe because he told him if anything happened to them, he'd come and do nasty things to her. But they became her best protectors. And what the moral of the story, the point of the story was, sometimes the change that you're really most afraid of, that you feel is really going to be terrible, is going to open doors and create changes that you would never have been able to imagine or work out on your own. And the change has been really brilliant. So that's one of the stories. And it was good for me as well. It was sticking to my guns, saying what I wanted, and working hard to get through to the change, the event I wanted.
Yeah, and that's so, so relevant right now, because a lot of people over the past, you know, 18 months, 2 years, they've either lost their jobs or they've got maybe new opportunities because of the new environment that we're all living, this sort of hybrid world that we're now moving into. And it can seem really scary. And actually, sometimes it's at those moments that the best opportunities turn up, don't they? And I think your story there is really relevant right now, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose if we go from the past to the present, the current situation, on a lighter note, another guy I worked with is a fantastic guy. I won't say his name, but he's the head of the open source community in the UK and quite senior, nasty. But his challenge was that he was obviously a brilliant programmer, brilliant computer guy, and the world was Microsoft or PC or Macintosh, very proprietary. And one of the biggest expenses for the NHS, which I don't know how your listeners know, is it's IT. You know, it's a massively IT intensive organization. And so the Microsofts of the world, they put a lot of effort in to win those NHS contracts, hugely valuable. And he was doing some work for the NHS. Well, sorry, he wasn't doing some, but he wanted to do some work for the NHS, and he didn't get the contract because his stuff was all based on Linux. But he did the job better, faster. And he came up with an idea. So he was knocked back. This is a change. And he could have, it was shattering. You know, he'd done a lot of work. He got the answer. He was going to save money. He was going to give people all the desktop functionality of Microsoft. He was going to support it. And it's going to be something like a third of the price. And then that included having staff on-site managing tech support, the whole lot. It was just massively cheaper. And they knocked him back. And they knocked him back because, shorten the story, because it was Linux. And the NHS didn't understand Linux. It didn't have a track record. Yeah. It was all open source. And the NHS had got this feeling that if it's open source, means not secure. Actually, it's the reverse, you know, because there's not enough people out there hacking open source stuff. There's no money in breaking open source software. You get the money from breaking the proprietary stuff. So what he decided to do was he would leave the word Linux out of all the proposals. He was going to resubmit the proposal, but he took Linux out and just put the functionality and wrote it in such a way that they could assume it was Microsoft and use a bit naughty, but made it look like it was Microsoft. And again, because they didn't understand the stuff, he ended up winning this massive contract, which set his business up. The ability, which he didn't get from me, because we met later on, and he was telling me this as an example of why he wanted to work with me and how he understood about the value proposition is the most important thing. That's it. Your message has to be a value proposition, not a description of the value. Yeah. I'll say that again. It's a value proposition is a value proposition. It's not a description of the value. So his version of the value was Linux is open source, means that, you know, it's cheap, it's available, it's robust because people can test it. it's the future. He really believed passionately that the costs are too much exploitation. So that was the value he was going to bring to the NHS, in massive. But it wasn't a good value proposition, because what they needed, what they valued, was security, reliability, lots of, you know, not being handcuffed to a specialist provider, which when you're in open source, it's actually the very opposite. But they thought Linux, well, that's special. Microsoft, oh, that's, everybody's got that. Everyone understands that. So it's the flip.
So it's attaching your message to the values of the people listening, not just expanding on what you perceive to be the real values are.
That was it. And then when we were, this is how he helped me. When we were talking, I was delivering some training for his company. And I always get taken, I know it's something about personality, I always get taken to one side by the boss. Don, can I have a chat, please? So I got taken aside by the guy, and he said, the stuff you're teaching my staff isn't presentation skills. And I said, yeah, it's presentation skills course. He goes, no. And I thought, oh, God, this is a good contract. I don't want to lose it. And then he said, no, it's much more than that. Because he was a really smart guy. He said, it's much more than that. You know, they're coming back and they're talking, they're really enjoying it. But I don't know what you're talking about, but, you know, presentation skills in there, but something else is going on. And we spent some time thinking about it, and I didn't know what it was. And years later, my big transformation, my change, when I realized that companies didn't want necessarily to teach their staff to speak better. What they wanted them to do was communicate a message to the marketplace that would let people buy more stuff.
Yeah. And that's true for companies and it's true for individuals, isn't it? It's not about getting up on stage with a whole load of tactics. And we were talking earlier about, you know, sneaky tricks for speaking better. It's actually about connecting with people. And as you say, allowing them to buy either something that you're trying to sell them or buy into you as the speaker.
And that's fantastic, Simon, because that is so important for leaders. Never been more important. Another quick story. I'm not sure if it's answering your question, but I think it's relevant. So another manager came on one of my courses. And the reason he came on the course was because he used to have an open door policy. Anybody come in and talk to him, and he got everybody's staff there, and he'd come and have a coffee if I had a problem. It was like, you know, go and have a coffee with John, he'd sort it out. And that was his style, very collaborative, cooperative, connecting with his staff on a day-to-day basis, which he's really good at, you know, senior manager for some time. Along comes COVID, and it's all at a distance. He hasn't got the backdrop of the room, the open door policy, all that is meaningless now because it's a Zoom call, and he's just a square head with all the square heads. So even being on stage is different in the virtual world because you're not on stage.
Yeah,
you know, you're just another head. Okay, when you're speaking, you will come up, but generally, and then you don't know how big you are on the screen. They might have you in a little corner at the top while they're playing charades, or I don't know what people are playing. So what he wanted to do was learn how to communicate and get that rapport, that relationship virtually. Through me, because I hadn't done that. I didn't know how to do that, what to do. And we came across that your preparation, and this is counter, I don't know if it's counterintuitive, but it's definitely not what people are doing. Because what people are saying is, I've got an hour meeting. It only takes me an hour now. Because, you know, I click on Zoom, I get, you know, put the backdrop I want on, put my shirt on, and I've got my, you know, my underpants, nothing else. And so, you know, an hour's meeting only takes an hour on Zoom. And it couldn't be more wrong.
No.
Couldn't be more wrong. You have, as a leader, maybe not for staff, it may be like, but for, as a leader, you have to prepare so much more for a Zoom presentation or for a virtual presentation, Teams, etc., than you would. So what would normally take you an hour was going to take you at least an hour and a half, maybe 4 hour 45, because you've got to find out who's going to be in the room. What's the topic? How are they feeling? You've got to have, I wouldn't say tricks, but you've definitely got to have some strategies for engagement. Because when you've got somebody in a room or in a conference hall, that's where they are. They may be distracted by the other people. There's no, when they're in their home on a Zoom call, you don't know what's in the plane. What are they seeing? There's a television, there's a TV, there's a lawnmower. There are so many things that are vying for their attention. It's not, okay, the CEO's giving an address on Zoom tonight.
Everything stops. No.
Everything stops. No, it's okay. Yeah, it's only a Zoom call. I've got Zoom calls at the clock with the CEO. Just be quiet, everybody. But no, so one of the things that I think the value proposition, or this idea of understanding your audience, it's much more important for a leader to understand who's in the room, how you're going to maintain engagement, what's important to them. Because if it's not important, they will, I think that my new term is zoom out, not zone out, but zoom out. They're there, but they're not there.
Yeah, totally true. Thanks for that. There's so many insights there, and I'm sure people at home listening to this are getting some real strategies. And the thing about strategies is they're so much more powerful than tactics. Strategies is how we think about things, how we approach things. And as you said, it's not about turning up for an hour and going through the routines. It's about strategizing beforehand, thinking about it, working out how you're going to make the biggest impact. So awesome. Don, this is where I ask you to share a story from your life where you've had to implement all of this great thinking and mindset stuff that you help other people with. You've had to implement that in your own life. So I don't know if you've got anything interesting to share on that side of things, but what have you got for us?
Well, yeah, in without further hesitation, we talked about this earlier. This is something I've only grown comfortable with sharing quite recently. And hopefully that will make sense to your listeners, and now bear with me. So on July 13, 2016, I had a stroke. I call it my cornflakes moment, because I was eating my breakfast and I was trying to raise a spoonful of cornflakes to my mouth to eat it, and I couldn't do it. Now something went wrong, and I sort of didn't think twice about it. I shook it off and did it. But that was actually the first warning that I had a stroke. I then proceeded to go through the full day, and I was feeling my stomach was queasy. I felt really bad, but I never attributed stroke. So if anything, it's a warning. You know, always err on the side of I'm having a stroke. You know, thinking you're having a stroke when you're not having a stroke is not a problem. Thinking you're not having a stroke when you're having a stroke is a major problem. So please, if there's anything funny happening with your mobility, your movement, how you're feeling, and there's no explanation, strokes, the standard ones are you squeeze both hands, you know, check your balance, and if your speech is slurred or one side of your face is drooping. But those are just the biggest signals. There are a lot of other minor signals. So particularly as you reach certain ages, you've got to be aware, part of your personal health check. And that, I say that because stroke is an incredibly debilitating situation. I woke up in the hospital in a coma, and I didn't leave my bed for about 2 weeks. And even when I was discharged, I had to have my bed downstairs. I couldn't walk, talk, or chew gum.
Nice. So
things were pretty bad. So that was when I really had to dig deep and think about the things I'd been, you know, you can do it. Yes, you can. All these motivations I've been teaching in schools and everybody. Mike Tyson said, everybody has a great plan. Every boxer has a great plan when they get in the ring, but it goes out the window when they get the first punch to the side of the head. So that's what, right, you know, when, you know, reality is so much different to the simulations. So one of the other things that happened when I was in hospital, there were friends of stroke survivors come around the wards, and one of these guys came up to me who had a stroke, survived it, and had but still had some of the debilitating impacts. And what he said to me, and I'll obviously never forget this all my life, he said, you've had a major stroke, so I'm here to let you know that you will recover, you will get better, but forget about ever being 100% again. Because nobody recovers 100%. Well, that was the wrong person to say that to, because I'm a mismatcher. If you know you know, do profiling like me, I'm a mismatcher. So as soon as you say that to me, I'm like, nah, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
I got hold of a book by a lady, fantastic book. I'm trying to think of the name of the book now. It was right to put my tongue. but it was about somebody who had a stroke, and it was called A Stroke of Insight.
Wow.
Because she was a neurological scientist who had a stroke and was able to observe herself having the stroke from a clinical perspective while she was having it.
Mm.
And she did recover 100%. But what the key thing was, it took time. Yeah. And what I learned was that, and this hopefully applies to all your listeners, doesn't matter what the challenge is, it can be resolved. The only variable is time. How long is it going to take? Mm-hmm. So I've studied NLP, and one of the things that Milton Erickson says, he was asked, Milton Erickson is the father of hypnosis, and he was in an interview, he was asked, can you hypnotize anybody? Can anybody be hypnotized? Milton Erickson said, yes, I can hypnotize anybody. I mean, some of them I'm still working on, but I can hypnotize anybody. So it's always a function of time, how long. So over the last 6 years, I've recovered incredibly. The number one thing is I lost my ability to speak. And when you're a professional speaker, not being able to speak is a little bit tricky. So I also had aphasia, which is where what you're saying isn't what's going on in your head. So they were big challenges. But I recovered from those. They're quite neurologically difficult things to recover from. But I was speaking. In fact, I was back on stage 8 weeks after the stroke. So I couldn't walk. I couldn't move up. You know, my son helped me go on stage, got in position. One hand was in a sling, not because it needed to be there, but because it just looked odd having an arm floating in the air for no reason. But I was able to deliver the speech. And my question to myself was, why? And it's because I 30 years of experience in business, education, and training and facilitating had created a dense neurology that bleed in my brain that damaged so many things. There was enough associative wiring and neurological connections that it was able to rebuild that very rapidly.
Mm.
That's why my passion has always been speaking and presenting, but that was boosted by that, because I knew that training and coaching modern leaders to articulate their business value proposition at DNA level, whether it's written, spoken, on video, online, offline. But I knew I could help them do it personally, making that personal connection, powerfully to have an impact, and most importantly, profitably.
Yeah.
Because all things being equal, people do business with and work with people they like. And all things being unequal, people do business, work for people they like. So if you can get that connection and get your value proven, I think it's the most powerful thing any leader can do. And I really believe that passionately.
Definitely. So coming back to your story in all of that then. So you've got up on stage the first time and found that you can still present because of all of the neurological associations in the brain. But we both know that part of a presentation's power is in the movement as well. So how did you overcome that challenge?
There is, I've got the video of that thing. I haven't released, I've been told I should do it. It's quite good because two things in there, Simon. One is, if you watch a modern video where people have been taught by speaker trainers with different methods than my own, there's a big common things where they're told you've got to have lots of hand gestures, you know, you connect hands. So if you watch YouTube videos, start watching them now, you'll see a lot of people just waving their hands meaninglessly because they've been told to do hand gestures.
Yeah.
And I believe, like me, being a student of personal development, you'll know who Jim Rohn was. And Jim Rohn was the absolute master.
Yeah.
And Jim Rohn, and I studied him more than ever after my stroke because I didn't know how much movement I'd get back. But you're told these, don't stand behind the lectern, don't use notes, lots of gestures and lots of movements. Now you look at the Jim Rohn video, he's behind the lectern. This guy's had been delivering for 50 years. He knew his stuff inside out, so had his notepad in front of him, referred to it to all the times. And his hand, one hand would move every now and again to articulate a point. But his face and his micro movements were a masterclass.
Yeah.
And tonality, masterclass. You know, you've got one thing where he says, I get paid a lot of money to speak, I don't need a lot of money, but I take the money. And just in those three phrases, but in one sentence, it just communicates so much. His tone in there. I use that example to our tone. So yeah, so I was very aware of that. And I do believe there are micro movements, which I, again, look, plug, I teach people that, you know, how I show them the gross movement, show them just a, like if you're having a conversation with somebody and they just lean forward as the slightest amount, you know they're interested. Or if they lean back and just scrunch their face up. So I think movement's incredibly important. And depending on your style, if you're Tony Robbins, you have to do giant size movements because that's your brand. That's how you do it. That's what people are expecting. And that's your energy. But if you're Jim Rohn and you're, I mean, if you, again, listen to a Jim Rohn presentation and nearly there is no filler. There's no padding. Everything he says is on point, delivered, and it's messy. You're really, and it's all about you. It's all about the audience. And it talks about the seasons. It talks about tractors, you know, old Texan guy. It's very practical and relatable, and it translates internationally.
It certainly does. I've listened to a lot of Jim Rohn, read a lot of his stuff, and as you say, it's not about the dramatic gestures. It's about getting the point across and helping people understand it and connecting again. I mean, there's an immediate connection with Jim Rohn, and it's superb. So, Don, thank you so much for sharing so much with us here today. Tell us, Don, how can we get into this? If people want to find out more, want to work on their own presentation skills as leaders, what advice have you got for them to finish off with, and how can they get in touch?
Okay, well, I'm going to throw you a curveball. I just remembered I'm the president of the Birmingham International Speakers Club. So they can always, if they're in the West Midlands, they can come along to that and they'll see me there on the last Wednesday or the fourth Wednesday of every month. But of Simon, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity, because I am passionate about helping leaders to deliver their core message, their signature speech. My clients and mentees, I want them to explode positive change the world from the stage, whether that stage is the business desk or the boardroom or a conference stage, dropping knowledge bombs like rise to June wedding. That's my little rap link there. But yeah, so if you've got questions on how best to deliver your truth, offer your expertise, or share your message, and you think I can help you, please reach out to me. LinkedIn, I think, is the best way. But thanks again, Simon. I've really appreciated this. I've learned a lot in the last hour, and I hope your listeners have too.
Yeah, I'm sure they have. Thanks, Don. It's been an absolute pleasure spending time with you on the show today. So good luck with whatever's next on your trek to drop knowledge bombs around the world, and I will no doubt catch up with you again soon. Thanks, Don.
Thank you so much, Simon. Thank you.
That was The Change Show here with Simon Phillips. Go and have an amazing week, and we'll see you back here again this time next week. Take care.